परिव्राजिताचार्य अष्टोत्तर शत श्री श्रीमारेषि भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी प्रभुपाद की जय। तरंतराज श्रीमद भागवतम की जय। निताय गौर प्रेमानंदे हरि हरि बोल। समवेत भक्त वृंद की जय। आगवेष्टिय समग्र की आगवेष्टिय समग्र की आगवेष्टिय समग्र की आगवेष्ट श्री श्री गुरु गौरांग। Om Namah Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 21, Explanation of the Vedic Path. Today's texts 29 and 30. These are put together as one translation. We'll just do 29 responsively. Now the word meanings for 29. Te, they, me, my, matam, conclusion, avigyaya, without understanding, paroksham, confidential, vishaya atpaka, absorbed in sense gratification, hingsayam, to violence, yadi, if, ragaha, attachment, syat, maybe, yagye, in the sacrificial prescriptions, eva, certainly, na, there is not, chodana, encouragement. Te me matam avigyaya. Paroksham vishayatmaka. Hingsayam yadi ragasya. Yagya eva na chodana. Te me matam avigyaya. Paroksham vishayatmaka. Hingsayam yadi ragasya. Yagya eva na chodana. Te me matam avigyaya. Paroksham vishayatmaka. Hingsayam yadi ragasya. Yagya eva na chodana. Hingsayam yadi ragasya. Yagya eva na chodana. Te me matam avigyaya. Hingsayam yadi ragasya. Yagya eva na chodana. Tene matam avigyaya. Paroksham vishayatmaka. Hingsayam yadi ragasya. Hingsayam yadi ragasya. Yagya eva na chodana. Te me matam avigyaya. Paroksham vishayatmaka. Hingsayam yadi ragasya. Yagya eva na chodana. do text 30 together. Hingsavihadayaladhai pashubhiswasukhetaya yajante devatayagyai pitribhutapatinkala. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada's disciples. Those who are sworn to sense gratification cannot understand the confidential conclusion of Vedic knowledge as explained by me. Taking pleasure in violence, they cruelly slaughter innocent animals in sacrifice for their own sense gratification, and thus worship demigods, forefathers, and leaders among ghostly creatures. Such passion for violence, however, is never encouraged within the process of Vedic sacrifice. Purport. The Vedic scriptures sanction occasional animal sacrifice to satisfy cruel, low-class men who cannot live without the taste of flesh and blood. Such concessions, however, are restricted by rigorous obligatory rituals and are meant to gradually discourage animal killing, just as the exorbitant cost of a liquor license restricts the number of retail outlets selling alcoholic beverages. But unscrupulous persons misconstrue such restrictive sanctions and declare that Vedic sacrifice is meant for killing animals in order to enjoy sense gratification. Being materialistic, they desire to attain the planets of the forefathers or demigods, and thus worship such beings. Sometimes materialistic persons are attracted to the subtle lifestyle of ghosts and worship ghostly creatures. These methods constitute gross ignorance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the actual enjoyer of all sacrifice and austerity. The demons perform Vedic sacrifice but are inimical to Lord Narayana, for they consider the demigods, the forefathers, or Lord Shiva, to be equal to God. Although understanding the authority of Vedic rituals, they do not accept the ultimate Vedic conclusion, and therefore never surrender to God. Thus, false religious principles flourish in the demoniac societies of the animal killers. Although in countries like America, people outwardly profess to be followers of God alone, actual worship and glorification is offered to innumerable popular heroes, such as entertainers, politicians, athletes, and other equally insignificant persons. Animal killers, being grossly materialistic, are inevitably attracted to the extraordinary features of material illusion. They cannot understand the real platform of Krishna consciousness or spiritual life. Om Ajnana Timirantasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Nivitamena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Krishna is covering so many topics in his instructions to Uddhava. Here he's being quite straightforward about his matam. We often hear Krishna say, mama mata, or mama matam, my opinion. But we all have our opinion. Everybody has opinions. But Krishna's opinion is absolute and always right and authoritative. So here he's saying, those who are sworn to sense gratification cannot understand the confidential conclusion of Vedic knowledge as explained by me. So the first point here is there are persons who are sworn to sense gratification. Griha-vrita-nam. They've decided that no matter what they hear, no matter what anybody else says, their goal in life is to enjoy sense gratification. I often think about this term in relationship to devotees, actually. We talk about the devotees and we have to give up sense gratification. Now we know, of course, it means the four rules. But then I always, especially sometimes when devotees are giving class, I'm wondering, I wonder what's in the back of their mind, what the devotee is thinking of. when he's talking about devotees and sense gratification. What kinds of sense gratification are devotees interested in? Practicing devotees. I think we have some idea what might be going on. Maybe we don't have a full idea. For some, it may be not breaking the rules, but spending the rest of my day doing all kinds of things that aren't directly Krishna consciousness, aren't part of sadhana. That may be all kinds of mundane media we can absorb ourselves in. That is certainly sense gratification. Now, on the other side, somebody may be avoiding all of those things, and then they're always chastising themselves, judging themselves for maybe eating a little too much or sleeping a little too much. So that's sense gratification too. So I think we have a whole range of sense gratification and all different levels of sense gratification that are available to us. But we know in principle we're not supposed to be doing those things. Sadhana bhakti, as Prabhupada would say so many times, means 24 hours engaged in Krishna consciousness. 24 hours engaged in chanting Hare Krishna. Prabhupada would sometimes say, in reference to this, we'll be talking about Vedic sacrifice today. So Prabhupada would often point out how it's not possible to do it today. No one is qualified. But we can do the sacrifice of chanting Hare Krishna, and we can do it 24 hours a day. So doing it 24 hours a day means no outside engagement, no sense gratification. So our conviction when we take up Krishna consciousness is, I'm going to give up sense gratification completely. Ultimately, that's my goal, to give up all kinds of sense gratification, just engage in the service of Krishna. Whereas those on the other pole, the other extreme, their idea is, I'm going to give up everything else and just engage in sense gratification. I'm just, everything is about my pleasure, my satisfaction, my selfish goals in life, how I'm going to accomplish those things. So the Course Krishna here, he's talking about the Vedic context. So he's talking about karmis, what we would call karmis according to the Vedic understanding. So they do their endeavors for sense gratification are often in the context of Vedic sacrifice. They perform sacrifice to satisfy their desires for sense gratification. So Krishna says, such persons, they can't understand me because they're always thinking of what am I going to get for myself, how am I going to satisfy my desires. Their mind is plugged up with those things, those thoughts. So they can't understand Krishna. It's not easy to understand Krishna. It's not easy to understand God because his position is so far beyond us. And even when he explains himself, it doesn't, as we say, it doesn't compute. It doesn't register. It doesn't sink in. It's like sometimes a teacher has a student that's just kind of dull and they just say, they try and try and try to get the message across, but it just doesn't. They may fail the grade sometimes in school. The student has to stay back because the teacher gave all the lessons but didn't sink in. So even people study the Vedas, if they're always thinking of sense gratification, it doesn't sink in. They don't understand really what Krishna is saying. So that's the first point Krishna is saying here. They can't understand the confidential conclusion of Vedic knowledge as explained by me. Because, of course, Vedic conclusion means, or Vedic knowledge means so many things. It means knowledge of everything, all different departments of knowledge. And it certainly includes also how to get sense gratification. We will teach you that in all different fields. We know, of course, even there's the Kama Sutra, which is connected to the Vedas. And I don't know the history of it, where it came from or so on, but an interesting point that Jiva Goswami makes in the Tapasandarbha is that, of course, we accept the Vedic literature and we accept the Puranas and ultimately the Bhagavatam, but we don't reject those that are ancillary, those are connected. Might you consider lower aspects of the Vedas? He mentions, for example, the Ayurveda. We don't reject the Ayurveda because it's not the Bhagavatam. So everything is there because it's all for running human society, for the organization of human society. So how to get sense gratification is also there. But that's not the confidential conclusion of Vedic knowledge. The confidential conclusion, you have to look a little harder for it. There's one place where Prabhupada says that the Karmakanda section of the Vedas is 80% of the Vedic literature. So it's easy to find how to get sense gratification in the Vedic literature. You have all kinds of whatever sacrifice or whatever thing you want, you can find a sacrifice for doing that. But the confidential conclusion is harder to find. So that's the first point Krishna makes here in this translation. So then, interestingly, in the second sentence here, he says, taking pleasure in violence, they cruelly slaughter innocent animals and sacrifice for their own sense gratification, and thus worship demigods, forefathers, and leaders among ghostly creatures. So I find this whole topic of Vedic sacrifice quite bewildering. Not sure I have a really good grasp of what it's all about, how it works. I'm reading the Bhagavatam, so many places, there are all these different kinds of sacrifices. It comes up all over the place, of course, Vedic sacrifice. In fact, sometimes I wonder about it. Why is there so much emphasis on Vedic sacrifice when this really didn't go on until Treta Yuga? Tretayam Yajito Makai performed Vedic sacrifice in Treta Yuga. Then it became deity worship after that, supposedly, in Dwapara Yuga, then Harinam in Kali Yuga. Before that, Satya Yuga was meditation. But Vedic sacrifice seems to pervade everything we read. Even in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks so much about Vedic sacrifice, even though it's the beginning of Kali Yuga. So my point is that it's all over the place. It's all over the place in the Bhagavatam. But to try to make sense of it all, I find it to be quite difficult. So anyway, here it says that it's characterizing Vedic sacrifice in general. Krishna is speaking, he's characterizing it in general as being violent, Vedic sacrifice. The people who want sense gratification, they perform these sacrifices and they cruelly slaughter innocent animals in sacrifice for their own sense gratification. And what are they doing as they're cruelly slaughtering these innocent animals? They do this, why? To worship demigods, forefathers, and leaders among ghostly creatures. So it sounds like that this is, that the people are doing these under these things, these karmis are doing this under the guidance of the Vedic literature. So somehow this is part of it. Now we hear something different, which I'll get to. And who are they worshipping? They're worshipping the demigods, forefathers, and of course leaders of ghostly creatures. So first of all, they're worshipping demigods. Now of course we know there are different levels of demigods. There are very high demigods. And then there are, of course, this universe has so many different levels. So there are demigods. Sometimes the word demigods is used to include practically anybody above the earth. Prabhupada would group them all in as demigods, anyone who's out there above us. And then sometimes demigods are used to refer to the lokapala, those who are in charge of lokas, the planet, different planets of this universe, or different aspects of the material universe. So the word is used in different ways. So one can be worshipping the demigods in different levels of different demigods. But even in those sacrifices, apparently there's sometimes slaughter of animals. Slaughter of innocent animals, as it's described here. Looking in the Sanskrit, what does it say? Alabdhai, which have been slaughtered. Hingsa vihala, those who take pleasure in violence. So the word is hingsa, so it's considered violence. Alabdhai, which have been slaughtered, pashubi, by means of animals. So they're worshipping these demigods and they're worshipping the forefathers, the pitris. That's another whole subject that just don't really understand what that's all about. Pitri, the pitriloka. Incidentally, there's a planet called Matriloka also. And there's also, so I don't know what's there, the four mothers, and there's also a group of demigods called the Matrika demigods. So I don't know, maybe they live on Matrika Desh, Matrika Loka. Anyway, we usually hear about the four fathers and not the four mothers. And these four fathers, they're sometimes offered flesh in sacrifice. Because we know there's this shloka from the Brahma Vaivarta Purana that five things are forbidden in Kali Yuga. And one of them is to offer flesh to the demigods, to the forefathers rather. So apparently it's not, in other ages, it's not forbidden. In Kali Yuga, it's forbidden. So what, I'm always thinking of implications of things. So I think, well, what's the implication of that? It sounds like the forefathers are eating meat. Otherwise, why is somebody offering them flesh? And it would seem like the people who are offering them flesh, they're also eating that because they're eating the prasad. From what, so that means they're meat eaters themselves and they're trying to go to Pitri Loka. And when they get there, somebody else is going to be offering them a flesh, except in Kali Yuga, I guess. So they have to fast, like the, you know, the Catholics used to fast for meat on Fridays. So they have their meatless Kali Yugas, the forefathers. And then, of course, leaders among ghostly creatures. So that means, of course, lower. There's different, sometimes we hear, Prabhupada states it somewhere, I think, about people worshiping some ghost in a tree or something like that. I remember going someplace in India, I was traveling in India. Right in the middle of the town, in the bazaar, there was a little shrine there. And there was a deity in there. It was kind of like the town deity. It was, I forget what her name was. It was some expansion of Durga. There are all kinds of expansions of Durga all over the place in India, where people worship them. Or else they're just some kind of, you know, lower devata, village deity or town deity. Maharaj?
Yeah, actually it's extremely popular all over the world, worshipping ghosts and spirits, and almost all the shamanic traditions are connected to that, and it's all over the planet, so that's why.
Yeah. I don't see it too much in America, but maybe it's there somewhere.
Yeah, actually it is, very much so, we're just not aware of it. It's very
especially
popular.
In South America more, I think, yeah, there's a lot of that. Yeah, so they worship these. Yeah, what is it in the purport? It says something about attracted to the subtle lifestyle of ghosts. So people like this idea. What do those ghosts do? They can inhabit someone. They can possess. They can take over someone's body. They think, oh, this person has some opulence I'd like to experience, so let me do that. So they do that kind of worship. So Krishna, here he's saying they slaughter innocent animals to do these things. Then he says, such passion for violence, however, is never encouraged within the process of Vedic sacrifice. So we've been hearing in previous verses how it's like giving a child medicine with candy. So we're not, the Vedas don't really encourage this violence, but it's there for those who are addicted to eating meat. So I wanted to read a few things that Prabhupada says about Vedic sacrifice. Now, Prabhupada has a certain message that he tends to give when he talks about the killing of animals in Vedic sacrifice. And I think you know what that is, but let me read a little something here. This is from this is from Bhagavad Gita, second chapter. Killing on the battlefield on religious principles and killing animals in the sacrificial fire are not at all considered to be acts of violence, because everyone is benefited by the religious principles involved. The animal sacrifice gets a human life immediately without undergoing the gradual evolutionary process from one form to another. And then the Kshatriyas go to the heavenly planets, as do the Brahmanas who attain them by offering sacrifice. So here Prabhupada is saying it's not even, it's because it's beneficial, then, you know, the animal gets a human life also, and then it's, so there's nothing, the violence, it's not really violence. Of course, in one sense it is, because you're killing the animal, but because the result is beneficial, it's not considered violence. Now, something related, this is in the third chapter, text 12, the Gita, purport. The meat eaters are recommended to worship the goddess Kali, the ghastly form of material nature, and before the goddess, the sacrifice of animals is recommended. So this is something we often hear. If you're a meat eater, then you have to follow certain restrictions. And you offer, for example, a goat. I think that may be mentioned here later. A goat is offered, never a cow, in sacrifice. And this is specifically for the purpose of eating the animal. You can do it, but you have to offer it in sacrifice. I always wonder where this is exactly, where this rule is in the Vedas. Is it, you know, hidden away in one of the I don't know, one of the four Vedas. I suspect maybe there are different kinds of tantras which explain. And then there are tantras in different modes. There's the Satvata tantras, which are... Tantras means basically rituals, how to do things. So there are tantras for different modes, and there are tantras for those in the mode of ignorance. So even then, they're guided by the... It's under the Vedic umbrella. So there, that's probably where you would find this kind of thing. I don't know, did it come out yet, the article that Mayapur Shashi wrote in BTG about Lord Buddha? I don't remember which issue. Anyway, he wrote an article on Lord Buddha, and he used to be a Buddhist, this devotee Mayapur Shashi, for quite a long time, actually. He was an officer in the British Army, I think it was. Anyway, he talks about Buddhism there, and he talks about nonviolence, and he explains you can't really justify that the Buddhists are supposed to be so nonviolent that even in Buddhist countries, there's animal slaughter going on. But he mentions that this one festival that goes on in Nepal, which is mostly Hindu. It's a Hindu festival, actually. And a lot of Hindus go from India to Nepal for this sacrifice where they kill like thousands and thousands of animals. There's just practically blood flowing in the streets from this so-called sacrifice that they're performing. So it's so ghastly. You think this is a sacrifice? You know, we think of sacrifice. Actually, the word sacrifice is related to the word sacred. It's supposed to be a holy thing, and it's killing thousands and thousands of animals. So I assume they're doing it because they're going to eat them as part of the sacrifice. So I don't know if there's some obscure scripture. I suspect that it's a perversion of something that was bona fide in the past. So now here's something. Now Prabhupada's going to talk about Ashwamedha Yajnas and Gomedha Yajnas. So horse sacrifice and cow sacrifice. This is from 1.18.52 purport. Ashwamedha Yajnas or Gomedha Yajnas, sacrifices in which a horse or a bull is sacrificed, were not, of course, for the purpose of killing the animals. Lord Chaitanya said that such animals sacrificed on the altar of Yajna were rejuvenated and a new life was given to them. Of course, this is in the context of Lord Chaitanya speaking with the Kazi. It was just to prove the efficacy of the hymns of the Vedas. By recitation of the hymns of the Vedas in the proper way, certainly the performer gets relief from the reactions of sins. But in case of such sacrifices improperly done under inexpert management, surely one has to become responsible for animal sacrifice. Now, I got quite a few purports that say essentially this same idea. Prabhupada repeats it quite often, that the purpose of the sacrifice was to test the mantra. That's why the animal was killed, to make sure the mantra was going to work. Which to me, it's funny to me that it's called a horse sacrifice, where this is just kind of part of the, you're testing the mantra, but still you call it a horse sacrifice. It's not really sacrificing the animal. Of course, the animal is being killed. But that it's known as that seems a little strange to me. Horse sacrifice or cow sacrifice. But anyway, that's the point. So then I think, well, why do you want to make sure that your mantras are working? Right? So that you can rejuvenate the animal? No, that's not the point of it. That's just the test. Prabhupada says it in one purport. He says it's like they sometimes in laboratories they sacrifice animals. But then he says, of course, they can't rejuvenate them. But the Vedic priests could rejuvenate them. Now, sometimes it says, as the first thing we said, Prabhupada says it gets a human life. In other places, Prabhupada says that the animal gets a new young life, becomes a young. And I always wonder, what does that mean exactly? Does the animal right there, somehow come back as a young colt, whatever, little pony comes up out of the fire? Or is it dies and then it comes back, it's reborn somewhere, like everything gets reborn. But anything that's killed gets reborn. So I don't know what that means exactly, how it's reborn, is it, in a cow's body, gets rejuvenated. So it's not considered sinful. Anyway, this is a point Prabhupada makes quite all over the place. Here he says later in another purport, Some old animals would be sacrificed, but in exchange for their old bodies, they received other new bodies. But then, okay, so then we think, well, it's okay, the Brahmins can do that, they have that power, but if they don't do it right, which Prabhupada implied in an earlier one, if they mess up and they don't have the power in their mantras, then they're responsible for that killing. So when Narada Muni is talking with King Prachina Barishat, it says here in the fourth canto, this is a translation, the great Saint Narada said, O ruler of the citizens, my dear king, please see in the sky those animals which you have sacrificed without compassion and without mercy in the sacrificial arena. I'm just going to read this purport. It's getting late, and then I'll stop. It covers some interesting points. So Prabhupada says, because animal sacrifice is recommended in the Vedas, there are animal sacrifices in almost all religious rituals. So that's pretty striking. However, one should not be satisfied simply by killing animals according to the directions of the scriptures. One should transcend the ritualistic ceremonies and try to understand the actual truth, the purpose of life. Narada Muni wanted to instruct the king about the real purpose of life and invoke a spirit of renunciation in his heart. Let's see. Okay. No, I'm just going to skip a little bit. Karmis are generally engaged in sense gratification, and for this end, they are prepared to commit so many sinful activities. Animal sacrifice is but one such sinful activity. I thought it said it was okay to do it. But anyway, doesn't it says, you'd think if it was recommended in the Vedas that it would be okay. But here it's described, Prabhupada says here, animal sacrifice is one such sinful activity. Consequently, by his mystic power, Narada Muni showed King Prachina Barishat the dead animals which he had sacrificed. So anyway, this Vedic sacrifice thing is quite bewildering to me. And of course, a point that Prabhupada would make repeatedly is that fortunately we don't have to worry about it. But one thing I think is that we spend a lot of time actually talking about what you might call the very arcane knowledge of the Vedic literature. You might say, well, who cares about Vedic sacrifice that happened in a previous age? But that kind of thing is all over the place in our books. Of course, Prabhupada would tie it in to us, connect the course, how what we say, we don't have to do these things, we chant Hare Krishna. But still, there's a lot of information in our books about these kinds of things. Although I find that sometimes it's sort of like pieces of the picture and it's hard to put it all together and really see, well, what was it really like back then, living in those times? And how did this go on? And because, of course, people were doing sacrifices. Not there are different kinds of sacrifices. There's sacrifices that you do at home every day, and there's all kinds of shastras having to do with those, the Griha Sutras, because there are sacrifices that you do at home. Then there are the big sacrifice that the state put on by the state, state-sponsored sacrifice, you can say. There's rule books about those. So it's so vast. Of course, we're talking about a whole culture, so it's hard to understand it all. But there is a lot of that. This, and sometimes I think, well, what's the point, actually, of knowing this kind of thing, understanding these kinds of things? So it seems to me it's just, we know, we present this as ideal culture, and even though it's hard to understand it, hearing about it is good for us. It has a purifying effect. And of course, ultimately, as is always pointed out in the purports by Srila Prabhupada and by our acharyas, it's connected to Krishna. That point Krishna is making here, that these, if you're only into it for the sense gratification, then you're just being violent, and this is thoroughly condemned. But if you get the confidential message, then it makes sense. That's what ties it all together. So if you're missing that piece, then it really doesn't, and you can say it doesn't have much value. Jugupsitam dharmakate nushasatam. It's so shocking, actually, that what Narada Muni told Vyasadeva. I condemn all these Vedas of that you've written, all these rituals. They're jugupsitam. It means abominable. It's abominable, all that you've written. Such a heavy thing, Vyasadeva said. But we can say, well, yeah, it's abominable if people just take the external and they don't see Krishna there. So you had, because they're missing Krishna, point it out to them directly. Tell them this is what it's all about. I haven't been clear enough. You're so dull-headed. So sometimes the teacher has to say, listen, let me just explain it for you. Simple, you know. Your brain, you can't accept it, I know. You're thinking about some other thing. So let me just lay it on the line for you. This is the point, okay? You get it now? It's all about Krishna. It's all about, that's what it's about. Ultimately, it's about devotional service to Krishna. It's about our relationship to Krishna. So sometimes a lot of these things, it's hard to see the connection. But of course, that's why we have our purports, to help us see the connection. And that's how we gain ultimate benefit from it. All right, a translation again. Those who are sworn to sense gratification cannot understand the confidential conclusion of Vedic knowledge as explained by me. Taking pleasure in violence, they cruelly slaughter innocent animals in sacrifice for their own sense gratification, and thus worship demigods, forefathers, and leaders among ghostly creatures. Such passion for violence, however, is never encouraged within the process of Vedic sacrifice. Madhamati Prabhu.
I was thinking that, so there is cow sacrifice. You have a certain conception of what these sacrifices are. You know, I mean, I think, well, the Kshatriyas, apparently, they ate meat. I mean, that's what I hear. I mean, I don't have any proof or anything, but you know, I have a certain conception about things, and now you're saying cow sacrifice. But it seems like the dog eater is considered the worst.
Mm-hmm.
So in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, there's horse sacrifice, there's cow sacrifice, and I think they ate the cows. I mean, I just remember reading books in India or something, you know, like Hindi books, and talking about the cow sacrifice, and the Brahmins would partake of it,
yeah.
Whatever kind of, they're all kinds of Brahmins. But then the idea of eating dogs, that's like, you know, shvapacha. This is like, keeps on coming, that's the lowest. So another aspect of it for me is like really bewildering, that why is that considered the lowest? Mm-hmm. And there was cow sacrifice, and as I said, I thought they do eat it, they do partake of it. So,
I wonder if that, of course, the sacrifice means there's prasad, so you're taking it as prasad.
Yeah.
So it's offered, and it's recommended in the Vedas, apparently, that you offer to certain demigods and to the forefathers.
So then
it becomes okay to eat it, because then it's prasad. But you can't offer dogs to the forefathers, apparently.
But yeah, what is this thing about the dog? I don't understand, why is that considered like the lowest?
Yeah, well, because it's not recommended in the Vedas, maybe. That's the answer. The Vedas don't recommend that you offer dogs in sacrifice.
So
you're eating boga dogs. It's not good.
That's like really bewildering to me, you know.
Yeah. Now, there's also, of course, there's this whole, you know, the stratification of Vedic culture, the higher, and somehow just culturally, those who do that, they're in the lowest status. Now, you could say, well, maybe this is circular reasoning I'm using here. But maybe eternally, a lot of these things we say, why? We just say, well, it's just eternally. That's just the way things are. It's always this way. I was thinking of something the other day. I feel it was. Well, maybe, oh, certain things like the idea of tilak. So we say, well, tilak is a part of eternal reality. There's always tilak. Or there's always, you know, devotees wear shikha. It's always going to be there. So certain things are always there. The swapacha is always the lowest of man, you know, lowest strata of society. That's just the way things are. That's the way Krishna created it. It seems to be that way. Because we hear about it in the Shastra, which is giving, you know, a picture of the eternal world where this is a reflection of it and so on. So I suppose that's one perspective of it. They're just, the swapachas, if you want to talk about low, then you use the swapachas. That's the person plays that role in society. Okay, Kali Paniku.
The grades of meat is that horses and cows are herbivores, and dogs eat everything. Mm. They eat stool and meat.
Yeah.
So there's no comparison of the dog meat and the other meat. So if you eat the animal, if you eat dogs, you become far more degraded than by eating the meat of herbivores.
It would seem that would apply more to why it's being used as an offering. That's why you wouldn't offer a dog, for example, because dogs eat everything. Or you wouldn't offer a pig, because pigs eat stool, for example. You wouldn't offer that to your forefather.
Yeah, but I wanted to point out that just as the Vedic people, so-called Vedic people, they were eating meat on the plea of the Vedas. And history has repeated itself, and now so-called Christians are eating meat on the plea of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many devotees have seen this article by Rabbi Gelman, but I've never seen a Western religious figure take such a clear stance for vegetarianism on the basis of the Bible as he does in this letter, which is, he has a column in national newspapers. And, I mean, it's long, but how many people have read this article? I'll just read a couple of excerpts, if you don't mind. He's asked a question that a Christian who eats meat and feels he's a hypocrite, he says...
No, he's a rabbi, just right?
He's a rabbi. He's a rabbi. The question says, I would never hunt or fish, and I contribute to animal groups, but this doesn't relieve me of my feelings of guilt at eating meat. So what would Jesus have said? And... Rabbi Gelman goes straight into it. He says in Genesis, God speaks to Adam, "Behold, I give you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for food." Nothing could be clearer. God does not want us to eat meat. The moral and spiritual ambiguity about eating meat is made more explicit in the 9th chapter of Genesis when God tells Noah in the covenant made with him after the great flood, "Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you, but flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat." So God has... God is saying that being a vegetarian is clearly the higher way. And then he says, "So what can I say to ease your carnivorous guilt? I would suggest that you experiment with meatless Mondays, and then no meat till dinner, and then maybe a period of time, and you eat no meat for a period of time. Your moral intuitions are right. There is something hypocritical about the way we profess life and then eat the world to death."
Yeah, it's really nice.
I want to write to this guy and tell him I love him.
You were mentioning about the Kshatriyas eating meat.
Put the microphone straight.
You were mentioning about the Kshatriyas eating meat. Actually, they ate only the male deer, not the female or the baby, and only before they went to battle. And they killed this deer with their own arrows, and they only ate the male deer, not the other. And another thing was, you were mentioning about the dog eaters being the most degraded, but actually to eat the cow is the most sinful. And
actually, I wanted to... Oh, you're not done yet? You're done. I wanted to read something. This is... Oh, here it is. I think I mentioned something about this in my last class, but I'll just read this translation here in purport. It says, this is from the 9th canto, 6th chapter, verse 7. "Thereafter, Ikshwaku's son, Vikukshi, went to the forest and killed many animals suitable for being offered as oblations." So he went out into the forest and killed them, and then brought them back to the priest. "When fatigued and hungry, he became forgetful
and ate a rabbit he had killed. I was just noticing we have a whole rabbit family on the altar this morning, Shyam Sundar's feet. So he killed to be offered in sacrifice. Now here Prabhupada says in purport, it is evident that Kshatriyas killed animals in the forest because the flesh of the animals was suitable to be offered at a particular type of yajna. Offering oblations to the forefathers in the form known as Shraddha is also a kind of yajna. In this yajna, flesh obtained from the forest by hunting could be offered. So then Prabhupada quotes how it's forbidden in this age. So that was what happened here was the priest, I think it was Vasishtha, he was doing the sacrifice. And when he got the rabbit, he said, hey, somebody already ate some of this rabbit. Can't be offered in sacrifice. Been contaminated. But he was going to offer it. You know, the dead rabbit and other animals were going to be offered, apparently, to the forefathers or some type of yajna. So that goes on sometimes. Even dead animals are brought in and not killed there right in the sacrificial arena. So, pretty unusual, wasn't it? It's hard to understand all these things, how it all fits together. Especially when you read, especially like in this course I mentioned before, there's a whole chapter about a human sacrifice. And Prabhupada doesn't say it's wrong, he just says it's been going on for a long, long time. And even in that one, it was Varuna. Varuna, there's a whole, I won't tell the whole story, but Varuna, Dev, the god, he's the one who wanted the sacrifice. Someone wanted a son, Harshchandra, actually. And then he prayed to Varuna for a son. Varuna said, okay, I'll give you a son. But the whole idea was that when he got the son, he was going to offer the son to Varuna by killing him in sacrifice. So Harshchandra keeps making excuses. Well, the animal is not suitable to be offered in sacrifice until it has teeth. Then it's not suitable to be sacrificed until such and such. And he goes on and on and on. And finally, the kid's grown up and he says, hey, they're talking about killing me. He goes away. Then it ends up that he buys some other kid. And that kid is the one who's supposed to get sacrificed. But Vasishtha rescues, anyway, this whole complicated story. But the whole chapter is about human sacrifice. So that's so bewildering because Varuna Dev is asking for a human sacrifice. Whoa. Wow, that's pretty amazing. So there's so many, you know, to get your mind around all these things sometimes. You just think, well, it is the Vedic age. Because that's one way I just put it. I said, how do we know what, you know, even 5,000 years ago, the things that went on at the Battle of Kurukshetra, there's so many mystical things. That's the other thing I think in our books. And I think, well, we just accept these things. Now, others might say, what? You believe this stuff? You know, there's all kinds of amazing things. We have little, you know, child in a womb. There's one pastime or episode where someone is trying to rape a woman who's pregnant and the child in the womb says, hey, stop it. They have talking babies and we have talking animals all over the place. And so we just accept these things as a matter of course because they're in the Bhagavatam. Of course, why do we do it? Because our acharyas accept them. We accept them as absolute authorities. But we just say, well, I don't know, I don't understand it, but it's there. And Krishna, Prabhupada agrees with it. And there are these huge numbers that we find all over the place. So we just, well, we can't get too upset about it. I guess we can't, you know, hurt our fate. That's why I say, just I was mentioning the Battle of Kurukshetra, so the kind of mystical things that went on, keeping the sun from coming up, or setting, I guess it was. There's all kinds of things, you know, mystical things that go on with the weapons. And that was only 5,000 years ago, and now we're talking about some of these things millions of years ago. And a lot of times in these sacrifices, demigods are involved. There's a lot of interaction in our books. A lot of things happen in the area called Aryavarta or Brahmavarta. Now that's usually described as the area between the Himalayas and the Vindhya Mountains. So that means North India. Or also it's sometimes described as the area between the Yamuna and the Ganga. So that area is where a lot of the things in the Bhagavatam take place. And a lot of times That's where Vrishabhdev was, and that's where he instructed his sons. That's where Manu was living. Swayambhuva Manu was actually living there and ruling over that. Of course, we hear about Manu in a universal sense. And all kinds, we hear about the demigods coming to sacrifices, and the big sages like Bhrigu and so on, or his descendants at least, they're performing sacrifices, which seem to be in India. And then demigods are coming and taking part. So all these things were happening historically, thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of years ago. So no wonder we can't figure it out. We're talking about long, long periods of time and a lot of interplanetary exchanges and travel going on. And so that's why there's a lot of mystical things. So, you know, it makes sense that we can't fit into our little brains all of these things. It always disturbs me because I want to understand it. Sometimes you just say, well, you're not going to figure it out. Your brain's just too small. It's like I've been trying to understand quantum mechanics, but I can't understand it. I even read it. Actually, no, it was relativity. I was just curious about Einstein's theory of relativity. So I read this book, you know, they have all these for dummies books. So relativity for dummies, but I was too dumb to understand it. Even the for dummies book was too far. So the Bhagavatam is kind of for dummies too, but even that's above me. Kali, oh, okay, Gadagaja, you get the mic, hold it up.
It's not
like you're drinking
not,
it.
The reason you can't understand it because it's not a fact; it's a theory. So,
oh, that. Well, I don't understand
it's
the theory.
Someone else's theory, which.
Well, I know, but I don't understand
it's
the theory.
It's not a fact. I mean, I'm not saying correctly. It's just that I'm saying it's a theory; it's not a fact.
Well, I know. Okay.
Even relativity is a.
Yeah, well, that's kind of irrelevant to my point. Kaliapani?
I know it's late, but I was wondering if you could give me some help with the problem that I have. It's about Sanskrit pronunciation. And I ask you, because you're someone that I can't criticize on your Sanskrit pronunciation. I tend to think less, my mind thinks less of devotees because of their not following the diacritic marks in the Sanskrit. And 99% of devotees don't pronounce the Sanskrit properly. And it clearly says long A and they pronounce it short, or long I and they pronounce it short, or vice versa, or many other things.
Yeah.
And my mind criticizes, it seems so simple to me to just read what's there. And it's brought me to think less.
I can't help you with that because I have the same problem. I did mention in class one day of how it just seems like many devotees just don't have an ear for it. They just don't hear the difference. And I've had the experience it's kind of like I want to harp on it. In fact, it's something I've been thinking about for a long time, and I think, should I do it this year on Vyas Puja? I've been thinking for years that I should just sit down and go through every syllable of Prabhupada's Pranam Mantra. Say, this is how you pronounce Prabhupada's Pranam Mantra. I could have Mata Mati. See, Mata Mati, I'm always worried that I'm mispronouncing things because she knows how to pronounce everything. But I think there are two things. One is that devotees don't hear. And I also do think that devotees aren't really concerned about it. There's kind of an attitude that it doesn't matter. But if you look at Lokanath Swami's book, which, by the way, is on his website, I guess it's called lokanathswami.com or something like that, his book that he wrote about Sanskrit pronunciation, which I think is maybe a little too technical and it may be intimidating for a lot of devotees. But at the early part of that book, he has all these quotes from Prabhupada about how Prabhupada did definitely take it seriously, Sanskrit. He wanted us to learn how to pronounce Sanskrit properly. And I've made the point before that if you're not doing it, if you're massacring the Sanskrit, especially in something like Prabhupada's Pranam Mantra or the Tulsi Prayer, of course, that's Bengali, but they're very closely related, then you may just be saying complete nonsense. In fact, you may be saying something really vulgar or offensive. In fact, I was thinking, when I was thinking of this idea of doing Prabhupada's Pranam Mantra, if I did something like, now this may make you feel uncomfortable, but, just like if I did it in English,
I offer my neglectful lambastuses unto the locust fleet of my, you know, you think, oh, I don't want to hear that. That's so offensive, you know. But if you're saying that in Sanskrit, you might be saying something completely crazy in Sanskrit. And you're supposed to be saying with awe and reverence to Tulsi Devi or Prabhupada or Krishna. But if you're saying complete gibberish or cursing or who knows what you're saying, then maybe it's a good idea to try to, you know, pay a little bit of attention. And I think part of the, one of the main problems is, first of all, it's actually quite easy because Sanskrit is 100% phonetic. It's always the same. Whenever there's a long A, it's always pronounced the same way. It's not like in English where you have B-U-T, but, and P-U-T, put. It's the same letter, but they're pronounced differently. In Sanskrit, it's always but, put, soot, hut. It's always the same. It's always on. So you don't just have to look at that little guide at the back of our books that tells you how to do it, and then read what's there. Don't, you know, just skip over it, but actually read it. Now, I think partly, as I was saying, some devotees just have a hard time with it. I think it's because they have a hard time seeing each syllable. I think that may be part of it. So they don't know where the syllables break up. That may be part of the reason why they have a hard time doing it. But I think it's something that, you know, devotees should maybe apply themselves to a little bit. Pull out the songbook, look at the verses, the songs that we sing at least every day in the morning program, and look at every single syllable, because every single syllable matters. You're giving me an opportunity to get on the soapbox here. This is something I think about all the time. Just like in English, every syllable matters. It's just not some quirk of Sanskrit that you have to get it right. We have to get it right in English, too. If you say the wrong syllable, then people will say, what? What did you say? You know, if I say prig instead of pig or something, it's like, well, it's not the same thing, you know? It's almost the same. I just added one little letter in there. So devotees do that all the time. In the morning prayers, they say a long syllable or a short. Usually it's short. Well, it's all mixed up, actually. I mean, I hear every day when I hear devotees singing Samsara Dhavana Lalita Loka, I could pretty much tell you every mistake that every devotee who leads Mangal Arati does. And the other prayers, too. Because I, you know, I'm listening and I just happen to notice. But the only cure, I think, is that, you know, devotees have to put some effort into it. And I think part of it, you should realize that Prabhupada did care. And if you read those quotes, you read what Lokanath Swami has collected. He and Radhika Raman, they worked together to put that book together about Sanskrit pronunciation. And you'll see, there's one talk where Prabhupada, you know, I'll mention it, it's getting late, I'm sorry, but as an aside, how we like to repeat things, you know, we repeat the verse. So you're listening, now Prabhupada didn't repeat everything, but one reason why Prabhupada repeated, because he repeated the sloka word for word and syllable by syllable originally, was because when Prabhupada first introduced the system of Bhagavatam class every morning, there was nothing written. There was no chalkboard at the very first times that Prabhupada did it. The devotees were just hearing what Prabhupada said, and then they had to repeat. So that's why Prabhupada very carefully went syllable by syllable, and then he went line by line, and that's why he repeated. Then he didn't repeat everything else. Some devotees like to repeat so much, I think they're going to repeat, you know, every line to the purport, too, eventually. But this is how this idea of repetition came, because the devotees were sitting there listening. But there's one tape where Prabhupada, he has the devotees chanting each one, and then he says, no, do it again. Then, no. And I just saw it in writing, so I don't know what the devotees are doing wrong. But sometimes they're doing something wrong. And Prabhupada says, no, do it again. Do it again. Do it again. He had them chant the verse over and over and over again until they got it right. So he definitely cared about it. There's no question about it. And there are many other places where Prabhupada, you know, and he made a joke of it that they say Garu instead of Guru. Or Guru. So Guru or Garu means cow. He said, the Guru is not a cow, he said. And he kind of chuckled. But he noticed. He did notice, you could say. So, you know, Prabhupada expected us. And he didn't think it was a big thing. He said, no, the records are there, he would sometimes say. The recordings are there. You can listen to the correct pronunciation and you can learn. And also, of course, the Prabhupada is why we've taken so much, you know, painstakingly given the exact transliteration of the verse. So you can read it and see how it's supposed to be pronounced. And that's why we have the transliteration. So again, it's not that hard, but you have to pay attention. You have to have some desire to do it. And once you learn it, then you see, oh, that's a long... Now, sometimes I think I go through a list of all very common words and how they're mispronounced. Just like the other day, someone was giving class, and he kept saying Kalia, Kalia. Everyone likes to say Kalia. It's not, it's the same, the serpent's name is not Kalia, it's Kalia. The long, the first syllable is long, Kalia. And devotees like to say Ajamil, Ajamil. It's not Ajamil, it's Ajamil. The second syllable is long. So it's just a question of not reading what's there. If you read, now you can say that, you know, long syllable, you know, technically a long syllable means it's held twice as long as a short syllable. So you think, what? You know, what does that mean? But the effect of it is, it just, it's accent in a sense. You can just say, just like when you may have learned to do poetry when you were a kid, you look at the, you know, the accented syllables. So a jamil, you know, the accent is on the longer syllable. Technically, it's not exactly an accent, but that seems to be the effect of it. Anyway, that's a little something about that. I think I better stop, quit while I'm ahead or not ahead. All right, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.